国、澳大利亚、加拿大等国宣布外交抵制北京冬奥会。美国众议院就三项中国人权问题法案进行表决。民主峰会开幕在即，美国民主学者驳斥中共宣传。大家好，欢迎收看《美国观察》，我是平章。首次民主峰会将于明日召开，而美中之间围绕民主问题的争论越发激烈。对此，专门研究民主问题的专家怎么看？我们将在稍后的节目当中带您关注。美国观察的节目热线已经开通，欢迎您拨打00212029204990给我们留言，跟我们分享您对节目的看法，也告诉我们您希望看到的节目内容。首先来关注今天的新闻。在美国星期一宣布外交抵制2022北京冬奥会，以表达对中国侵犯人权行为的抗议后，英国、澳大利亚、加拿大、苏格兰等国也采取了相同的做法。英国首相约翰逊星期三宣布，英国将有效实施针对北京冬奥会的外交抵制，英国政府不会派遣部长或高层官员出席北京冬奥会。澳大利亚、加拿大和苏格兰政府也在同一天宣布跟进。澳大利亚总理莫里森表示，该国也是由于中国侵犯人权的问题，决定对北京冬奥会进行外交抵制。加拿大总理特鲁多说，我们对中国政府一再侵犯人权的行为感到极为关切，他们不应该为我们不会派出任何外交代表感到惊讶。美国总统拜登星期三签署了一项行政命令，将让联邦政府的规模与采购力发挥杠杆作用，使联邦政府在2050年之前实现碳中和，在2030年之前将其温室气体排放减少65%，以此作为美国政府抗击气候变化的努力的一部分。拜登的指令要求在2030年之前让政府建筑的用电100%免除碳污染，在2035年之前让联邦车队100%使用电动车，在2050年之前让联邦政府的货物与服务合同实现无碳化。美国国会众议院议长佩洛西宣布，他已经安排院会在星期三就三项有关中国人权的议案进行辩论和表决。其中一项议案是防止强迫维吾尔人劳动法，该法案旨在确保中国新疆强迫劳动制造的商品不得进入美国市场。该法案今年七月获得了国会参议院两党议员的一致通过。另一项法案谴责中国继续针对维吾尔人和其他宗教以及少数民族实施种族灭绝和其他犯罪行为。第三项法案是认定国际奥林匹克运动会未能遵守自身对人权的承诺。佩洛西星期二在一份声明中说，通过这三项法案，众院发出了一个清晰和直接的信息，中华人民共和国针对维吾尔人的犯罪行为构成种族灭绝罪，必须立即停止。佩洛西今年早些时候就敦促拜登政府对北京冬奥会实施外交抵制，他的这一立场据信为白宫最终做出外交抵制的决定起到了重要作用。长期关注中国人权的共和党议员史密斯八日呼吁通过防止强迫维吾尔人劳动法，这项得到两党议员支持的法案的目的是确保中国新疆强迫劳动制造的商品不得进入美国市场。民主党众议员逊斯说，美国应该尽一切力量挺身而出维护我们的价值观。北京一直否认新疆发生了种族灭绝事件，称这是西方国家试图压制中国发展的世纪谎言。
习近平's genocide. And make no mistake about it, this is Xi Jinping's genocide. He is personally responsible, having ordered it. The rape and sexual abuse of women being held in internment camps, so-called internment camps, forced abortion and involuntary sterilization to prevent the birth of Uyghur children are in direct violation of Article 2D of the UN Genocide Convention, which states in part the genocide includesimposing measures intended to prevent births within a group. Forced labor at a massive scale that allows Chinese companies to profit and profit big time from modern day slavery.
As the world is watching us, and it starts with the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act becoming law, let's do this and let's do it together. We recognize here in our country that we went through a period of slavery. That's why it's so offensive to us now.to see slavery actually happening in the world as we speak. where both administrations, the prior administration and this administration, have both said this is genocide. Standing up together in a bipartisan way is so important. And I yield back.
General.
总部设在美国加州旧金山的付费网络媒体信息独家披露，苹果首席执行官库克为了安抚中国政府，在2016年与其签署了一份2750亿美元的秘密投资协议。报道援引独家获取的苹果内部文件称，2016年中国突然加大了针对苹果业务的监管，库克于是到中国灭火，并在第一次访问中签署了这份为期五年的协议。报道称，中国当时认为苹果公司对中国当地经济贡献不足，库克因此向中国游说，并向官员承诺，苹果将通过投资、商业交易和工人培训，尽力帮助中国的经济和技术实力发展。据报道，2016年5月，苹果宣布向初创公司滴滴出行投资10亿美元，帮助后者在与优步中国的竞争中获得优势。同时，作为协议的一部分，苹果承诺将其设备中使用更多来自中国供应商的组件，并与中国软件公司签署协议，与中国大学进行技术合作，并直接投资中国的科技公司。报道还指出，库克曾经通过妥协打通了在中国的一些法律关节。倡导新闻自由的国际新闻工作者组织无国界记者在新发布的一份报告中指称，中国目前是世界上逮捕记者最多的国家，并称中国对新闻界的压制活动蔓延至全世界。这份名为《中国新闻业的大跃退》的报告指出，香港的新闻环境严重恶化，中国政府通过越来越多的手段控制信息，包括设置防火墙、请记者喝茶、强推学习强国应用和加强对互联网的控制等等。报告还说，中国是世界上逮捕记者最多的国家，目前至少有127名记者被当局拘留。另外，中国的外交使团也是压制民主国家信息自由的一个来源。无国界记者的秘书长德洛瓦说，中国政府拥有庞大的资金和技术资源来实现其目标，因此中国新闻业的这种大跃退显得更加可怕。美国众议院星期二晚间以363票对70票通过了一项7680亿美元的国防支出法案，比总统向国会申报的国防预算还高出了250亿美元。这项法案包含了多项强化美军实力以应对中国军事挑战的条款，包括授权为太平洋震慑计划拨款71亿美元，以及采取多项的具体措施来提升台湾的自卫能力。众议院军委会共和党领导人罗杰斯说，这项法案将帮助我们的军队做好准备，面对日益增强的中国威胁，包括更新我们的武器系统和禁止中国进入我们的供应链。
感谢致电美国之音美国观察的留言信箱，我们针对政治、外交、贸易、人权等议题进行深入报道，分享幕后故事，也欢迎您发表您的看法，并留下您的姓氏和所在地，我们期待在节目中分享您的观点，请耐心等待提示音后留言。
美国即将于12月9日至10日举办首届民主峰会，台湾受到邀请，而中国则被排除在外。中国政府不仅批评美国借民主问题来制造意识形态分裂，还通过在外媒发文和发布白皮书等多种方式宣扬自身的制度也是一种民主。对此，专门研究民主问题的专家怎么看？我在不久前和斯坦福大学胡佛研究所的高级研究员，也是民主研究领域的领军人物戴雅门进行了一番对话。
Dr. Diamond for speaking with me today. President Biden is going to host the first ever summit for democracy on December 9th and 10th. How do you see the significance of this event? Can we expect any substantial fruit?
Well, I think certainly we can expect the substantial fruit of countries coming together to renew their commitment to democracy, human rights, and the rule of law. And I think we can also expect that countries in attendance will make commitments to advance the themes of the summit, such as fighting the authoritarian trend in the world, defending human rights, combating corruption, and trying to secure democracy where it's in trouble. So I think it's a good thing that countries are coming together around democratic principles, either countries that are democracies or at least where there's democratic prospects underway, and that the United States is exerting leadership again without imposing or controlling the agenda unilaterally.
President Biden has invited Taiwan to join the summit. Do you think it's a wise move?
Yes, I do, because Taiwan is a democracy, and it's called the Summit for Democracy. It's not called a summit of independent sovereign states. And so we don't take a position on the dispute between Taipei and Beijing over the status of Taiwan and the statehood of Taiwan by inviting Taiwan to the Summit for Democracy. It's a democratic political system. It would be almost perverse not to have it there.
Speaking of the role of Taiwan, do you think it is still serving as a shining example of the transition from non-democracy to democracy?
Yes, I do. I think that no democracy is perfect. Every democracy has its elements of friction, controversy, difficulty, stress. But I think Taiwan is the most liberal democracy in Asia, and one of the most successful cases of democratic evolution and consolidation during the entire third wave of democratic change. And indeed, I would say the quality of democracy in Taiwan is significantly higher than in the United States now. So I give Taiwan's people and its president, Tsai Ing-wen, a lot of credit for the progress they've made in institutionalizing democracy and the innovation that has been brought through digital governance and, you know, creative engagement of civil society. I give President Tsai a lot of credit for her restraint and lack of provocation on the issue of the cross-strait dispute. You know, Taiwan is a vibrant democracy. The risk it faces is not from internal weakness or polarization, although the problem of inter-party politics, inter-party competition is always a challenge in a democracy that has as, you know, spirited a level of political competition as exists between the two major parties in Taiwan. But the real problem stems from the increasing bellicose posture of the People's Republic of China and the periodic warnings and intimidations that it may use force to solve the conflict. So I think it's a good, necessary and right step to include Taiwan in the Summit for Democracy.
The inclusion of Taiwan, of course, angered China, and China has been against the summit in an even larger sense. Recently, we've seen the China and the Russia ambassadors to the United States issue a joint op-ed decrying the democracy summit. They said, and I'll quote here, the U.S. plan is an evident product of its Cold War mentality, creating new dividing lines. So what's your take? Is the U.S. using democracy as a divisive geopolitical tool?
No, the U.S. is reaffirming its historic role dating back for many decades, but particularly since 1977, of supporting and embracing the cause of freedom, democracy, and human rights as universal values and as counterweights to projects of authoritarian domination and efforts to crush the human spirit, which the regimes in mainland China and Russia, unfortunately, very much embody. I think that any regime that is as deeply authoritarian as China and now increasingly Russia is, and that feels as insecure in its tenure as the leaders of the Chinese Communist Party state and the leaders in the Kremlin feel, any such regime is going to feel threatened when democracies of the world come together to reaffirm their commitment to democracy, to support democratic forces in the world, and to try to strengthen and improve their democracies. So this ideological, geopolitical, rhetorical bullying is no surprise, and it is very characteristic of the kind of rhetoric that we heard from communist adversaries during the Cold War. So I think the positive effort to embrace, improve, reaffirm democracy and human rights is in no way a Cold War gesture. But I do believe the kind of rhetoric and hysterical reaction to it that we are hearing from China and Russia is very much a Cold War reflex.
Apparently, the Chinese Communist Party dislikes to be called out as an autocracy. And in the op-ed I've just mentioned, the China ambassador argued, and I quote here, democracy can be realized in multiple ways, and no model can fit all countries. No country has the right to judge the world's vast and varied political landscape by a single yardstick. And he described it, the Chinese model, as an extensive whole process socialist democracy, of course echoed the statement made by the Chinese President Xi Jinping recently. So as a leader scholar in the field of democracy studies, do you think the Chinese so-called whole process socialist democracy is a real democracy?
I don't have a word for this that I can use on the Voice of America, but I will try to make it acceptable to your audience by saying it's a complete, preposterous, ridiculous, Orwellian fiction to pretend that the Chinese Communist Party neo-totalitarian state in any way reflects or represents democratic values. And I would invite the Chinese ambassador and other, you know, officials of the Politburo and apologists of the regime to read the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights and explain to a global audience what portions of it they are not routinely violating. In Xinjiang, in Tibet, in Hong Kong, and indeed in all of China, by their ruthless suppression of freedom of thought, freedom of expression, freedom of association, religious freedom, the right to language and identity, the right to independent political expression, the right to choose and replace your leaders. I mean, there isn't any part of it that the Chinese Communist Party state comes close to respecting. So this is a ridiculous fiction that nobody takes seriously.
But the CCP has been promoting this model, both to its own people and to the world. But let's face it, it's working to a certain extent. There is a big chunk of Chinese public sincerely believe their political system is superior to the Western democracy, even within the young generation. Do you find it worrisome?
Yes, I do find it worrisome. And I think we need to separate, make two kinds of distinctions. The first distinction is between what is a democracy or not, and whether a regime is preferable or superior or not. You know, a regime could be preferable or superior, even if it's not a democracy, because it delivers economic growth, personal security, other things that people want. I think even on those grounds, if you look at the mass atrocities in China, if you look at the massive corruption in China, if you look at the unfolding real estate crisis in China, if you look at the massive indebtedness in China, if you look at the financial crisis that's looming in China, if you look at the demographic crisis in China, which is going to, over the next 30 years, lose 200 million working age individuals and gain 200 million senior citizens, that it's not making provisions for their social security. If you look at the resource crisis in China of increasingly scarce water, food, and energy, and I could just go down the list, it's hard to sustain the claim, and I think over time it will be increasingly hard to sustain the claim that the Chinese communist system is a superior system by its performance. As to the question of whether it's a democracy or not, I've made my point. And indeed, in a way, I think Beijing has made my point for me by clinging to, I think, in a kind of desperation, this fiction that China is really a democracy. It's just a different kind of democracy. They are revealing their own insecurity about the neo-totalitarian nature of their regime, and the fact that democracy is still the only broadly legitimate form of government in the world. So they feel that somehow globally they need to jump on the bandwagon. The second distinction that needs to be made is between what is believed inside China and what is recognized outside China. Outside China, the PRC may be scoring some propaganda campaign, incremental victories, and engaging in some successful disinformation. But its image around the world is actually in decline. And there is a very significant reaction at the popular level in Latin America, in Europe, in Africa, and elsewhere against the bullying and arrogance of the People's Republic of China. It is the case, I think it's difficult to dispute, that the regime, through its Orwellian control of information, propaganda, social media, and ideological indoctrination in the schools, universities, and so on, has had some success in socializing Chinese people, and particularly young people, into believing that the regime is legitimate and democratic. But I do not think it's at all clear that this is going to be sustainable as the deep contradictions in the system become more and more apparent.
Given that, how do you see the trajectory of China's political development in both the short term and the long term future?
In the short term, I think the regime will become increasingly, as I said, neo-totalitarian. It will seek to more and more comprehensively control information, aggregate information to control human beings. But I think the regime is going to have a tough time sustaining this because of the performance contradictions in terms of the economy, in terms of resources, in terms of labor, and so on, And because the regime, in its paranoia and its hunger for absolute power and suspicion and intolerance of any form of civic pluralism or diversity in sources of power and influence, is cracking down on the goose that lays the golden eggs, which is its technology sector and its big corporations that are not, you know, predatory real estate companies. And so I think, you know, once you have intimidated the most dynamic sector of your economy, which is private, real private enterprise and technological private enterprise, you've really inflicted a pretty serious wound on your future economic prospects. And this is another one of the contradictions that I think the regime doesn't seem to have a theory of solving. As Xi Jinping becomes more and more paranoid about his grip on power, about the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of enemies he has made in the Chinese Communist Party by his arbitrary and personalistic crackdown on, quote, corruption, end quote, which is surely there and needed to be reined in, but has had a good deal of power consolidation for Xi as a central motive. I think this system is going to become more and more unstable and dangerous.
Do you think the case of China reveals the reality of global democracy retreat?
Well, I think the case of China is both reflection and cause of the global democracy retreat. So in that sense, it reflects a global trend of declining democracy and rising authoritarianism, but it is also a major contributor to the authoritarian trend through its projection of sharp power, its ideological warfare, its wolf warrior diplomacy, its military intimidation of its neighbors in East Asia, and so on.
So what should the U.S. do to reverse the course of a global democracy retreat we're facing right now?
Well, I think there are so many things. I think gathering the democracies together to renew their commitments to democracy and human rights within their own countries and globally is an important first step. In the geopolitical competition and tension between China and the United States, China and other democracies, and Russia and NATO and Russia and the United States, I think at once we have to show strength and also prudence and caution. If we don't show strength and resolve, including military strength and preparedness, it will invite aggression. And at some point, if it looks like, you know, Taiwan won't defend itself, its friends won't come to its assistance, China will use military force to resolve the question. I have very little doubt about that, unless it is deterred. At the same time, I think we need to proceed with caution. We do not want to feed Cold War rhetoric or exaggerated fears on the part of the Russian and the Chinese leaders.
All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Diamond.
好，以上就是今天美国观察的全部内容。感谢您的收看，再见。